Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello there, it's me, Richard Herring. This is Rahulastapa, and we're at the Lowry in Salford at the moment. We do these things on tour. Here's one we did on tour as well. This is from Birmingham with Adrian Childs, who was very forthcoming. I hope you're going to enjoy this. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you want to come and see these shows live, there's some in London, there's some all around the country, and we're doing loads in Edinburgh. Go to richardherring.com/gigs, and you can find out when they're coming up. We've got brilliant guests like Tony Slattery and Lucy Beaumont in Edinburgh. Loads more to come. Phil Wang. We're going to find out all about what he was wearing in Taskmaster. It's going to be mainly about that. There's gigs all over the country and all into the autumn, and I'm sure into 2020 as well. Go to rahulastapa.co.uk if you want to join in and become a member and get loads of extras as detailed a couple of weeks ago. And if not, sit back, relax and enjoy Rahulastapa with my good friend Adrian Childs for free here on Rahulastapa, Rahulastapa. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Birmingham Town Hall. Please welcome a man who's wearing the same jumper he's wearing in the poster for this tour. It's amazing. It's Richard Herring. Yeah, fucking hell. Whoa, thank you very much. Whoa. Guys up there. Amazing. Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome to the podcast. This is Richard Herring's Lifting Soggy Tarpaulins podcast. Just change the direction a bit for... there's a lot of podcasts on the market now. You've got to find your niche. Whatever, I'm going to have a guest every week. We're just going to lift a soggy tarpaulin, find out what's underneath it. But I was hanging out at Mr. Egg the other day. Just late night, having a bit of an egg. Just got a late night hankering for an egg. The original Mr. Egg was there, not a new one, the original Mr. Egg, the good, the proper one. He calls it Rahulastapa, so I don't know if that's going to catch on. So this is amazing. There's 1,100 people in here today, this afternoon, which is the biggest audience I've ever had paid to come and see me. So... thank you for that, Birmingham. As I asked before, where were you on my proper gigs? Thanks for coming to this, though. It's lovely to be in Birmingham. The big news in Birmingham today, traffic chaos as the water, the South Staffordshire Water are replacing the water mains in Chapel Road. That affected a lot of you? There's people very upset about that. There was a sinkhole there, apparently. It went off crazy, but no, traffic's going to be... a lot of you thinking about the drive home now. Am I going to make it? Also, Birmingham is a horrible place, as you will have probably know. Birmingham, of course, is the home of the parents who don't want their children taught about homosexuality. That's what the rest of the world thinks about you.
I think they don't want anyone in Birmingham taught that there's anywhere else other than Birmingham that they could go to have something nice. The people who are trying to teach kids about homosexuality are called no outsiders, which could be interpreted in two different ways. That's the problem. They're trying to teach about tolerance. I don't know if that's deliberate, but it's good. And I have to be careful here because, of course, Birmingham people get very cross if they go to see a football match. They don't like the other team. Even if they're from the same city, they'll go and just punch someone. So I have to watch out. There's a lot of rivalry in Birmingham between the different football clubs you have here, which is weird, really, because, I mean, they're all pretty bad. So it's, I'd sort of keep it quiet if you liked any of them. Asking which is the best Birmingham football team is a bit like asking what is the best animal's urine to drink. It's a carpy, obviously, but that's, I wouldn't go broadcasting it around. Imagine being so angry about, I like cat piss. I'm going to punch that dog piss bloke in the head. Birmingham famously has more canals than Venice. Not really the number, is it? It's not really the number of canals that is. It's how pretty the canals are and whether they're surrounded by nice buildings and people on gondolas. That's the selling point. It's not, oh, we got more, mate. Don't go to Venice. We got more. I don't think anyone cares about your canals. If Birmingham was sinking into the sea, I don't think anyone would pay 25p more for their pizza. That's what I'm saying. What else have I got for you? Nothing else, I don't think. The traffic chaos. So look, we're going to crack on. Birmingham town motto, not as good as Manchester, but better than Wolverhampton. No, it's not bad, is it? That's not bad. You come third in most things, that is. So my guest today is probably best known as the sex party host in Sex Lives of the Potato Men. That's why you're here, sir. That's why you love that film, don't you? I hope you can get the sex party host guy. Unbelievably true. Will you please welcome Adrian Childs, ladies and gentlemen? He's from Birmingham. He likes football. Welcome. Pick up the mic for us for you. Talking to that. Adrian Childs from Birmingham.
I've just got a couple of apologies first. Number one, I can't imagine there's anybody left in Birmingham remotely interested in speaking to me or hearing from me who hasn't done so already in some pub or stuff. So I'm sorry. I'm particularly sorry for my brother-in-law who is here and called me last week and said, I've had that ticket for months. And now I've got to listen to your drivel again, which if I was interested, I could get for free anyway. So anyway, look, when they're trying to get me to come on here, they give a list of all the brilliant people you've had on in the past. That has the opposite effect on me. I say, Richard E. Grant and stuff. Why would anybody be interested? So anyway,
You were just the best I could get.
Well, many a true word said.
It had sold out before we booked you. And see, there's a lot of people.
The whole line gone there.
I'm very excited. As I mentioned backstage, I did used to drink in Cafe Nero in the same Cafe Nero as you in Hammersmith in King Street.
Yeah.
And I was sitting next to you one time and you had the same Sony Vaio as me. So the little one, it was a little Sony. It was a must date because I've been Mac for a while. And I said, oh, how are you finding the Sony Vaio? And you found it was all right.
Oddly, does it get any less boring than this conversation?
No, this is it. It's going to be mainly about times I've met the guests.
But I must be boring too, because I actually remember that. Only once in your life is somebody going to ask you about a Sony Vaio.
Yeah. Did you recognise me from off the telly?
I recognise you as the bloke who asked me about my Sony Vaio, is what I definitely remember. So I just heard you slate in Birmingham, which is fine. Yes, you were.
Given the news.
I think the important thing to understand about Birmingham is that It was actually pointed out to me by an Asian guy who was from Surrey but was the Midlands correspondent for the BBC for a while. And he said what he loved about Birmingham, he said it's the only place where people are different from people everywhere else. Manx are always telling you, we're the greatest city in the world. Scousers the same. Glaswegians. Geordies. Londoners. In Birmingham, nobody says that about themselves. No, we don't big ourselves up. I mean, And then there's no greater indication of that than a website, which I'm not sure it's still on, but it's genuinely promoting Birmingham, and it's called BirminghamIt'sNotShit.com, which is the best we'll ever say about each other. No, I spent a lot of time working in Manchester, and everywhere you go, they're saying, we're the best as a city. Well, that doesn't commend me to anyone. If a bloke walks into a bar and says, hey, I'm brilliant, I'm great, then you think he's a twat. So why would we not think that about people saying how brilliant their cities are?
Yeah, but if someone walks into a pub from Birmingham and go, oh no, they're from Birmingham.
Yeah. There's a certain amount of truth.
You can tell straight away.
Well, you know, we don't mind. We're sort of happy enough in our skin not to go around saying how brilliant we are. No.
Well.
Yes, thank you.
Don't applaud it. It's just admitting you're rubbish, that's all. So, what was the Sex Lives of the Potato Men job?
That was a guy called Andy Humphreys. He was a filmmaker and he was a big Birmingham City fan. And I interviewed him about an award-winning short film he'd made, 20 minutes. And I said, look, if you ever get a feature film, then I want a part in it. I said in jest. Then about 5 years later, I got a call from a casting agency, or the agent did. I said, casting agent, he wants to talk to you. And they said, well, do you want a part in a film called Sex Lives of the Potato Men? I said, well, what's that all about? He said, a bloke called Andy Humphreys. I thought, blimey, he's been good to his word. So I played myself as the host of a sex party. And it cured my love of wanting to be an actor because, you're paid to hang about. I mean, it was a tiny little role. And I was there 3 days and nights or something. It was astonishing. But I mean, Johnny Vegas is in this film, Mackenzie Crook, Dom, somebody, I think it was also in, it was also in The Office, can't remember his surname, nice bloke. But on the day it came out, it got a national release. Now, I didn't realise that films were, I mean, you can make the whole film and get the funding, and then it still can end up not being shown in cinemas or only a few cinemas, but it got a national release. And I was working on a programme, presented a programme called Working Lunch at the time on BBC Two. So we got Andy in to be interviewed by me on the Friday, and that was the release date. And I woke up that morning, I was actually coming down from Sheffield where I'd been filming something, and there was a copy of the Times in the lobby. And on the banner headline on the top of the Times was, is this the worst British film ever made? So poor Andy had his absolute moment in the sun, and it was absolutely slated by everybody.
Yeah.
But it's actually done good. It's done sort of fairly good business since on DVD. Whether Andy's got to make anything else yet, I don't know. I hope he's done well, because he's a really nice bloke.
What did you have to do at the sex party scene?
I had to undress. Nobody saw any tackle or anything, but I just had a... In fact, I started losing weight that day, because I was about 18 stone at the time, and I had to put a towel around my waist, and that was my costume. And so I put it on, and then I saw myself in the monitor, and after a few takes, and I just looked like an aging Joe Bugner or something. And then I kept trying to pull it up to get it over the spare tire, but then the continuity woman kept pulling it down again. But well, that was about it. I said, "All right, how you doing?" I think that was my only line. But
so we can't blame you for it not doing well,
no.
or doing well if it's
no.
doing well now.
No,
I've had both the stars on the podcast before. They were,
have they?
Yeah. I think it was unfairly maligned. Possibly, I have not watched it myself.
Well,
but it feels like people went for it, yeah. But in a bad way. Anyway, there's lots of things I want to talk to you about. Before you were a presenter, you did a bit of acting. You were also worked in the civil service. Is that what you asked?
No, I did a civil. When I left university, I then broke my leg and couldn't do anything. I came back home to Hagley near here and just couldn't walk for a year. And in that time, I thought, oh, I better apply and do something. One of the things I applied for was the civil service exams. So I wanted to be a diplomat. So I did the straight civil service exam and then the graduates exam and failed them both to my embarrassment. But then I got a card through the post and it said there is other government, this little letter said there's other government, though you were unsuccessful, blah, 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 there's some other government work for which you might be considered. And it was I remember the address was, if you are interested, or something, please reply to the Director of Establishments. I always remember, it seemed a peculiar phrase, Ministry of Defence, Whitehall, London or something. So I just wrote, no, why not, yeah. Then I got a call, well, OK, well, can you come to an interview? And it was addressed on the Tottenham Court Road. And then, well, I remember when I got there, mate had to drive me down because I still had my leg was still in plaster. And so I got to this address, and this woman took me into this sort of room. And said, have you parked anywhere? I said, no. I said, well, why'd you ask? And she said, because it's going to take about 3 hours. Fucking hell, what are you going to talk about for 3 hours? And it was the most forensic interview. I mean, no stone unturned. It was like, so tell me about your primary school. What were your friends like? Who you hang around with? And sport? And what did you do? And just there was no stone left unturned. And she got to the end. He said, now, I can tell you... I can't tell you what this job is about now. I thought, well, you know, that's a relief. And she said, I'm not from the Ministry of Defence, as you might have suspected. And I went, yeah, I don't know. he said, I'm from MI5. And I will never forget it. Literally, there's a couple of times in my life when the ground has shifted between my feet. I just could not believe what she was saying. And she said, right, I'm going to leave you alone now. You need to read this. And then I'll come back in. I can talk to you a bit more about what the job entails. So I was like, hyperventilating. And then, well, this document, it said classified and top secret. I mean, it literally is like something out of a... If you saw that in a comedy, you think it's not really like that, but it is like that. It did say those words on it. So then she left the room. And on reflection, I think I must have been being filmed then because I just... And if I was, it wouldn't have looked good because I was going, I just didn't know what to paced around the room a bit, looked at this thing, couldn't take anything in. And then she came in, she made me sign it. And then she came in and she asked me, and then she told me, I asked a load of questions, and she told me kind of what the job entails. Basically said it's very boring. I remember asking her, so what do your friends think you do then? What do you friends think you do for me? And said, look, you tell somebody you work in the civil service. It's an absolute conversation stopper straight away. There are no supplementaries. But she said, you can only tell your mom, you can only tell your immediate family.
Yeah.
So I went home. I didn't say anything for a while. Then I was sitting just having something to eat in the evening with my mum and dad. And I was getting up to this. I got told the whole story up to when she said, you know, I'm not from the Ministry of Defence. I'm from MI5. And my dad looked astonished. My mum looked baffled, and then the doorbell went. My mate was there or something, and then whoever it was went in the other room. Then I went back into the kitchen, and my dad was agog, but my mum was baffled. My mum's Croatian, and you know, then some the English isn't absolutely perfect, but she thought the woman had said, "I'm not from the Ministry of Defence. I'm from MFI," which. No wonder she looked baffled. Signing the Official Secrets Act. All for sort of flat pack furniture.
Yeah.
But anyway, then 2 weeks later, I got a note saying, we don't want you. Which was actually the right decision. Because something she said to me after, said, look, I get the sense that you need affirmation in your job. You need to tell people what you do. And obviously, if you're roughly analogous to kind of what you do. You know, you can't, it's not something you can do in secret. You know, you crave approval.
That's exactly what the Russians think. Playing the slow
game.
Anyway,
I think she made the right decision. Maybe. I mean, like most anecdotes, you exaggerate. I've exaggerated nothing there. I mean, it is.
Are you allowed to tell that story, though? Because this is going to go out.
No. I mean, I'm sure you're not, but I don't know what they're going to. If I get shot from long range or I die in unexplained circumstances, then I'll say, look after my family, will you?
I will do. The thing is, if you had got the job, you would still say you hadn't got the
job.
That's
true.
You'd say it more.
Who am I supposed to spy on? Like the crowd at West Brom or anyone who works for the BBC
or
something?
As we know, people in Birmingham are awful and need to be spied on all the time. If you'd been spying on that bloke before he went and hit that guy, you just could have stopped him, couldn't you? I know that wasn't West Brom, but it's all the same to me. Why did you choose West Brom out of the three or
six? Your clubs choose you, don't they? So I love my granddad, and my granddad was an Albion fan, so I sort of went up I went up every week with him, and it's just become an absolute illness. I thought it'd get better. I go there in the same spirit. I might go and visit an aged relative, you know, an ailing relative. You know, I go out of duty.
Yeah.
You do it, and then you leave, and then you go back next time. Interesting, my daughter, when she was little, I used to drag her there, and she, the younger one, sort of would go time to time. And but she didn't go anymore. She's now 16. And a friend of mine I go to the album with, she saw her elsewhere, and she asked her, so why don't you go? And she said, I don't mind being there. It's just the thought of being there. That's all. Well, actually, interesting, with me, it's the other way around. Being there is shit. But actually, the thought of being there, for some reason, excites me. Or rather, I find the thought of not being there absolutely unbearable. Right. It's interesting. If there's a game coming up, and let's say we got Birmingham next Friday night. If I knew I couldn't go there, if I knew I couldn't go to that game for some reason, I'd feel sick and wrong all week. Yeah. But at such time as that game finished, I wouldn't care at all that I wasn't there. Because if we'd lost, I'd be thinking, well, thank God I wasn't there. If we'd won, I'd be so delighted I wouldn't care. And if we drew, it'd be something in between the two.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was hoping I'd be released from this nightmare, but there is no end to it.
I support York City, so West Brom is, like, unbelievably high.
Yeah, but everyone. But I think that's a bit of a myth about which... there's the same pain for everybody in football, because...
Not whoever, as much as there is for York City, mate.
But if the pain, it's all relative. It's relative to what you expect to attain. So if you're a Manchester United fan, you know, it's a disaster if you finish second. So you've got that level of pressure. If you're a West Brom fan, it's a disaster if you got relegated, which we did. But, you know, it's finishing 17th in the Premier League was fantastic for us. So, I mean, everybody, apart from perhaps two fans of two teams, end the season bloody miserable. That's just how it
is. I mean, football's just stupid, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
That's what I would say. Don't worry too much about it. Not to, like, knock most of what you do in your job, but it's a waste of time. Why don't they all just play once and then just, that's it?
But I think perhaps they should just... not do anything for a year, just cancel football for a year, and everybody can just have a word with themselves. You know, like farmers used to have to leave fields fallow for a year. Just shut the fuck up about it for a whole year. Not worry about it, and then come back the following season. No transfer news, no ups and downs.
Well, hopefully we'll have another world war, and that's the kind of thing that happens. So if we have a world war, probably going to
Do you know, I have the season of 9/11. We got relegated. We had a nightmare season and we were facing relegation. I honestly found myself idly thinking, if there was an atrocity here, like a nuclear attack, they'd have to cancel the season in February and we couldn't go down. That's dark, that, isn't it?
It is.
Even if that involved my own death, it still felt preferable to relegation. So any Albion Blues or Villa fans here will know exactly what I mean by that. You know, we're all in this together.
It is. It's like interesting you say West Brom and knows in another city, people go, "Boo!" But everyone's going, "Yeah, we're all shit." There's no point.
Can you get somebody to move forward and sit in these seats?
It's like a whole family of Birmingham people decided not to.
Who's that? Oh, fuck.
everyone else still came. I didn't really broadcast who it was going to be. So let's talk about. I remember you from Working Lunch. That's when I first saw you. It wasn't a show I tuned into all the time because it was about business and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was working from home and sometimes Neighbours also.
It was interesting. So. And when that first started, somebody did say to me, look, it's just not going to work. It's a business programme for people who aren't interested in business, which is kind of true. And he was right, but it did last for 13 years and sort of got a bit of a following. Interestingly, I meet kids now who are watching it then you know, are now running hedge funds, driving around in Ferraris. You know, I meet them somewhere and say, oh, it's you that got me into business. I say, well, good for you as they get into their chauffeur-driven Bentley or whatever. So they're sitting as seven-year-olds watching it. And, you know, it did well by them. But actually, I'm prouder of that programme than anything I've done, actually. Because everything we did get on that, we you know, we kind of earned for ourselves. And also, it's in such a backwater, lunchtime on BBC Two. The big advantage of that is that nobody cares about you. You're not costing them much. As long as you don't libel anyone or do anything completely stupid, you can just get on with it. And sort of creatively, without, you know, bringing it to sound like a bit of a wanker, you can just get, you can try different things. If they don't work, try something else. If you're absolutely banging the spotlight on a, you know, doing, you know, football, Champions League football or something, there's precious little room for experimentation because you try something and, you know, the walls of hell come tumbling down upon you if people don't like it.
Yeah, well, that's why it sort of stuck out, because you were this funny presenter on a show that people were chancing. Because it was similarly, my last TV show was on lunchtime on a Sunday, which people weren't expecting comedy, you know, a comedy show or a rude comedy show. And so then it was like, oh my goodness, this amazing thing's happening that's sort of secret. But that was probably the secret of your success.
Well, I suppose it was. It was also having a Midlands accent, which people always say, you know, how do you get on telly with a horrendous accent like that? For me, I've always taken it as a positive, because there is no doubt about it. If people hear you with a Birmingham accent, they think you're stupid, right? It's just, we've just got to accept that. I never minded that, even at college, whatever, but certainly at the BBC, because you're just underestimated. You're better off starting any interview, any situation, with people thinking you are stupid, because then you've got to do relatively little to impress them. So... No, I'm absolutely deadly serious. So I went to, my first introduction to the BBC, I got on work experience through a friend of mine, a girl from Hagley, who was on work experience there herself, and on business programmes on the a television centre. And so I walked in there, just knuckles dragging along the ground, didn't know what to do. They never heard anybody with an accent like me, mine. And so they didn't know what to do with me. So then, I dragged myself into some planning meeting they were having. They're all sitting around, probably 10 or 15 of them. And I soon realised all I had to do was just construct one coherent sentence. I swear, they looked at me like, well, Stephen fucking Hawking or something. This boy is a genius. Oh, my God, he's something special. You know, but somebody who's been to sort of Charterhouse and Cambridge isn't going to have that advantage. I felt really sorry for a lot of them, because more was expected of them.
Fair enough. It is rude to all these people who have the same accent as you but couldn't get on TV, though, as a result. So that's...
Well, look, it's probably because you didn't try.
Yeah. That's true. Just turn up. Go, where's the pub for you? That's how you speak. Just exact replica of that. And so you kind of went on this journey, I guess, with your career, that they went from that to getting onto the one show.
I was a long time on working. I was 13 years on working, like, sort of barely noticed, sort of under the radar. And I was doing radio as well. Actually, the tipping point was The Apprentice, actually.
Yeah.
Which always felt like a bit of a cheat, because I don't think I'd really earned it. It was the, you know, I was the presenter of the after show, which in itself was piggybacking on The Apprentice itself, which itself was an American format that had been brought over here. So I remember talking to the controller of the controller of BBC One at the time, Peter Fincham, who said, look, you know, you said, think of it like this. You know, you score a tap-in in the semi-final, you know, the cop or something. You're not going to go, well, I didn't really earn that. Somebody else made the goal. Look, just put it in the net, son, you know, and you'll be fine. So that was kind of a big success. And then everything seemed to flow from that. You know, I found the whole rise at that point absolutely bewildering. And I found the equally precipitous decline just as bewildering, but obviously not in a good way.
Yeah. But that's it. Well, you know, it was going into a new era. I suppose that does make sense for that leap. But then was there any, when you got off, was the one show was it a thing that existed before?
No.
So you started.
No, that was. I mean, I always remember the previous controller of BBC One, Peter Salmon, said, you know, I would never have had the balls to commission that, because you think about it, you have given over a slot, however many weekdays in the year, I think it's 256 or 232 shows a year from 7 till 7:30, you've given that slot to a programme.
Yeah.
Now, if that programme doesn't work, it's a nightmare for a, it's a nightmare for the controller. Because what you do, you kind of stop with it. You can't pull it because then you've got to put a load of, you know, you've got to put 220 other shows in there. So it was real sort of balls to do it. We actually piloted it here, but it was an on-air pilot for, I think, for 3 weeks in 1 August in 2006. And there's an area by the canal at the back of the mailbox here. They built a studio there in sort of a porter cabin. And I look at that space now, and it gets smaller and smaller. I mean, you couldn't put a tennis court on there. So I don't know how we sort of managed to fit a program in. But the co-presenter then was Nadia Sawala, whom we got on well. And again, we thought, oh, sod it, it's a pilot. Let's just all ask right about a bit.
I went out with her sister.
No, not like that.
I went out with her sister.
Then it seemed to work. But I remember, I mean, we're into the second week. I thought we're onto something here. It was going to work. And I remember the season had started by then, and I was walking to the Albion along the Birmingham Road, and there was a bloke sat on a wall where the Hawthorns pub used to be. And he went, all right, Aidan. I went, yeah, all right. And he goes, the one show. He goes, fuck it. I went, that's all he said.
Yeah.
I went, you know, it's funny. I'll never get used to the... I'm not on social media at all. I'll never get used to sort of feedback, sort of, from the public. And it's not the kind of loathing you sometimes get, because people don't give you that generally in public. I mean, you might get a bit of stick, but generally people are nice to you or ignore you or, I don't know, laugh behind their hands at you. But, you know, I've had a whole array in my time. And there was one that absolutely killed me about 6 months ago, coming back from Manchester. And what classically what happens, the question I answer a million times a day, I mean, not a million, obviously not a million, I would say literally 10 times a day, is, oh, you're not on telly anymore. I don't know what the response is. I say, oh, no. Well, I've been fucking filming something. Are they not putting that out? But, you know, you're just, your shortcomings or your sudden lack of success, you know, are pointed out to you every day. And sometimes people look at you like a ghost, because to some extent, it's like you've stopped existing. They think you were dead or something. Yeah. But you know, oh my God, it's you. You know, it's. I can't
really identify with this.
No, no. I got on the tram in Manchester going from Media City to Piccadilly last week. There's a load of primary school kids on there with little high vis things. I've been on a trip to the Imperial War Museum in Salford. And so I started chatting to them. I had a couple of teachers with them and everything. They're really good kids. So what do you want to be? So I want to be a Marvel superhero. And then this other little girl said, well, actually, she stood up and said, excuse me, sir, would you like to sit down? I went, no, you're all right, Angel. Anyway, she wanted to be an actress, a singer, or a dancer. And she said, if I couldn't live my dream, I'd be a nurse. And I'd do all the mucky stuff. But actually, interestingly, so I'm sort of veering off a bit, but She then stood up and said, what did you want to be when you were little like me? And I thought, wow, what a great question that is. And the point is not what the answer is, which isn't that interesting. But, I mean, she had curiosity. I knew at that instant that little girl would go far. Because don't you think what you want from people is curiosity? I don't care anymore what people know or, importantly, what they think they know. I'm interested in what people want to know.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? If people just aren't curious about anything, I don't quite get that. But anyway, on that tram... I own that tram. Those kids bloody love me. They were it gave me more pleasure than anything I'd done in the 3 hours broadcasting I'd done before. Anyway, and also I knew they didn't know who I was or anything, so I thought, well, I've earned this. It felt like a performance. Anyway, I came to get off, and then one of the teachers stood up and said, children, can I say something? Something you need to know about this gentleman. He used to be famous. Bye, kids. And off we went. But anyway, on the train, I had the usual... I got on the train about 6 months ago. It honestly happened. The bloke opposite me was a really nice guy. He said, oh, I'm seeing you on telly anymore. I went, no shit. Can't think. Anyway, yeah. And I said, he's what we said... I said, you know, I do the football and everything. I do radio and everything. And he goes, do you know what? You tried your best. But it's a good job the train doors don't open on those verges. All right, yes, I did. Ta-da, then. And just...
Well, it's also because, you know, but it's that's the price of becoming super successful. So, like, it is getting beyond that level where the working lunch level, even the apprentice level.
Yeah.
And then you're in people's rooms every single night.
And then, but actually, it's interesting. There's a guy I know. He worked, he was head of, head of comms at West Brom. Very popular figure in the business. And in the end, he left for whatever reason. And he nailed it for me when he said, you know, the trouble and the kind of the issue he has, although he's become very successful again, is that the problem is when you're defined by what you used to do or what you used to be, rightly or wrongly. That's actually quite difficult. That's quite difficult to do with. There's another one, actually. It's one of the reasons I stay off social media. One of the many reasons. But it's interesting when you do a successful programme. If you do a programme that's not working well and everyone slates it, but then I did the programme about drinking, you know, which went down really well, even on, you know, I was told on social media. And then a friend of mine sent me a tweet somebody said about it, and he said, God knows, I fucking hate this cunt. But this is a brilliant programme. Where do you go with that? How do you process that?
But the thing is, I think as a comedian, you sort of... Well, some comedians don't realise it, but like ultimately, you can't... Not everyone's going to like what you're doing. As a comedian, you kind of realise it, because to be a good comedian, you have to have that reaction from certain people. Everyone who does that to me, I go, yeah, great, that means as long as everyone isn't doing that, I'm doing is working.
Yeah,
because I'm meant to be rubbing people
up. And in a way, I mean, that is the biggest compliment. If you can put it... If you can put a positive spin on it, then, you know, it must have hurt him. To like the programme.
Well, A, you like the programme, and B, you're a really amazing cunt as well. So that's another one, actually.
I remember New Year's Day, I was in Liverpool for a football match, and we had a few drinks, and then we were going up to Anfield, the Albion were playing there, and we're walking up, and there's a proper Scouser came down, I can't do a Liverpool accent, but he goes, hey, you're that cunt off the telly, aren't you? I went, yes, that's me. What can you say to that? Off you go. I'm getting quite stressed recording all. You just reminded me about something about testicles, actually.
Oh, really?
Earlier when you...
Okay, well, was that in a warm-up
or was that on air? You honestly put something in my head I've forgotten about. When you get over the age of 50, you can sit on your testicles. Well, I was 52 on Thursday and I haven't got to that stage. But I suddenly remember... I literally haven't thought about this in what must be 46, 47 years, seeing my granddad naked. And I buried it away, it was so horrific, but just how low they hung.
Yeah. That's the future, of your testicles. You've seen the future.
Yeah. The other testicle story I have, since you didn't ask, but I'll tell you. In 1978, it was the day that Arsenal played Ipswich in the FA Cup final.
Yes.
I got on my bike at lunchtime, midday, just had cycled a little dance down the road to my nan's house, and it was raining. And they had a short little steep drive. I was all excited to get down. I was going too fast. Put my brakes on because it was wet. Brakes didn't work. Smashed into the house, basically into the wall of the house, and sort of up against the window, but not through it, where my granddad was sitting reading the Birmingham Post. Anyway, I was howling. Went in to the front knocked on the front door, and they let me in. So I just lay on the floor howling, and then they looked down, and for some reason, maybe I later found out because I was covered in blood down here. They pulled my tracksuit bottoms down and basically I'd half sliced off my entire sort of pack. I don't know how else. So basically, The whole thing was like that.
Wow.
So it was hanging on. And then... So I remember my nan called my mom and said, yeah, I'm afraid you'll have to come straight away. Adrian's cut himself in rather a funny place. So then they came down. There I was, my trousers around my ankles, yeah, and my bollocks hanging off. Yeah. And they said, we better go to hospital. Quite right. So we went to the Corbett Hospital in Stourbridge. And an Irish nurse, remember, yep.
Cheer, because you recognise, yeah, the hospital. There's a boy, yeah, with his testicles hanging off.
Yeah. So the Irish nurse came in, I remember. The doctor had a look and he said, just sew it up, which seemed straightforward enough. So it was all sewed back. And, yeah, I had internal stitches and, yeah, you know, everything sewn back up. And I was put in this kind of harness. I mean, there wasn't a lot to that needed supporting. I was little, but I was only 11. So this little, to put this on, this harness, put my trousers on, went back in time for kickoff. Perfect. But then the neighbours started coming round. And I remember my mum, halfway through the first half, Ipswich had just scored. Yeah. And my mum said, your Auntie Kay's come round from next door to have a look, show what you've done. So I stood up. All right, pull my trousers down. This huge harness arrangement with this tiny little winkle popping out. All right. Okay, thanks. It's a bit sore. Anyway, sat down, watched the football. But actually, I didn't realise my parents were worried for years it would have some detrimental effect on my fertility, which, yeah, having fathered children, apparently it didn't. So whatever she did with those internal stitches, she put them in the right place.
And do you...
It's funny how you've got your legs positioned now. Told you that story. Yeah.
Do you have like a, is it like Frankenstein down there now? Is it all?
No, it's. You get the say, you don't really look at it much anymore, do you? So no,
they've all kind of got that scar up the back anyway, haven't they? So
yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, mate. It's where the penis fuses together in utero. We can talk about that more later.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So have you seen Back to the One Show?
Yeah.
Which is all I was interested in, Adrian. Right, okay. Thanks for the story about your severed penis and testicles that I did not request. Have you seen the new Alan Partridge show?
Actually, I must say I haven't. But I saw bits of it. But I think I was out somewhere. I didn't have my phone on. I switched my phone on. Then there was... I was like 40 texts. I thought, what's happened? Somebody died or something. I realised that he'd mentioned my name, which is a great honour. I mean, on that show, definitely, I was sob Alan Partridge. I just, it was, you know, you couldn't, I'm reminded of some of the stuff that happened. I mean, I don't think I was a twat, but I was a bit of one at times. But you just get used to, just used to just stuff happens, starts to become the norm, and just like little things, like remember there was one, you know, I wasn't allowed to go in my own clothes, and I wasn't trusted to be dressed properly, so you know, I'd sort of go in, and then you go into the wardrobe room, and there'd be a, there was a nice Australian woman who just told me what I was going to wear, and I gave up arguing. So I was, so she gave me some trousers, and I put them on, and then I put my shoes on, and then my phone went, I was on my phone, and then I thought, well, why don't you tie my fucking shoes up? I mean, subconsciously, I found, I was looking, I was going, you know, you might, and I just realised, she said, I think you can probably tie your own fucking shoes up. But I'd somehow come to, you know, it had somehow become the norm. And you become, like, footballers are completely infantilised in the sense that you go, you know, I went training with West Brom once. It was about 20 years ago. They didn't even have their own training ground, so it wasn't a well-funded club at all. So I went in all my football kit and everything because I was training with them. I realised the players don't. You get there, and my kit, like theirs, was all laid out. But, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
The pants, they were green Marks and Spencer slips, you know, little briefs.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like that. You literally could turn up naked or in your pyjamas or a suit of armour or whatever.
Yeah.
Fine. It's all laid out for you. So no wonder they become like hopeless sheep. You know, they're not allowed to look after their own passports. They don't feed themselves. Everything's washed for them. You know, it was a, you, be, you know, you became, I know, I certainly became infantilised. Like,
yeah. Well, if they were going to, TV is that, you know, that you can understand why, to an extent, why people go crazy in lots of different ways, sportsmen and TV stars, when you're treated with that level of, you're so important. So if you're a bit of an idiot, you'll get someone to tie your shoes. If you're a real idiot, you'll end up having to go to prison. Yeah. So it's, you know, because...
Well, no,
because,
look, absolutely.
Because, you know, because you're treated in that way, and then everyone is also, you know, you sort of see it. If the star of the show falls and is no longer the star of the show, everyone else falls around them as well. Yeah. So, you know...
But there was something about the pace of that show, because it was so breathtakingly quick. You know, you'd be on for half an hour or 27 minutes or whatever it is, and there'd be always be four films on there about, you know, there'd be, I don't know, cot death would then go into sort of badgers, would then go into something about the history of toasters or something. And then in between, you have to crowbar in a bewildered... I mean, the most bewildered one we had was Michael Stipe, I remember. He shortly retired from everything after... He retired from everything shortly after that. But you only ever had 3 minutes, maximum.
Yeah.
And if you think there's two of you presenting it, so you only get sort of one or two questions each. But I lost the ability to have a long conversation. I mean, even in the pub, I start talking to somebody, go, right, one question, two questions, right, okay, thanks, off you go. You forgot how to do something sort of long, you know, any, you know, just have a normal conversation.
Yeah. It must have been, you couldn't tell the story about cutting your genitals in half, could you? That would have been, wasn't time.
I don't think I have.
I'm really looking forward to watching this back, because we're going to put the sign out in a little box in the corner. I'm really looking forward to watching that that story back to see. You all saw it here. But you ended up leaving the one show because of only you were sort of peeved at Chris Evans.
Well, he wasn't. It was just. Look, I think anybody would feel the same. I was, you know, from that pilot we did out by the canal basin in Birmingham.
Yeah.
We turned it into this massive success. You know, 5 or 6 million people would watch it in the night, and then suddenly it was, oh, but we're doing a bigger show on Friday, and we don't want you to present it. We want Chris Evans to do it. Now, I've no ill will about for Chris Evans at all. I've always got on well with him, everything, but. You know, and he'd understand why I get the hump. If the boot had been on the foot, Chris Evans would have got the hump. So we tried for ages to say, look, just don't do it, don't do it. But the controller of BBC One was absolutely determined to do it. So then I would have been in the position of doing the, you know, Monday to Thursday, slogging away doing that show, and all the energy and excitement amongst the production team would be for the new, bigger, better, you know, one-hour show, which was happening on the Friday. So we tried to stop it. I mean, we got the same agent. You can imagine what, you know, imagine how furious he was, manoeuvring everything like mad. But it just couldn't stop. And then I was going to have to wear it. I was resigned to wearing it. In the 11th hour, ITV came in with a big offer. And so sort of, you know, off I went. But if that hadn't happened, there's no way I would have gone anywhere.
No.
You know, because why would I? I was doing The Apprentice, I was doing Match of the Day, I was doing the one show, and so on. I remember that just as it was looking as I was going to go to ITV, it was in the offing, I got a call from Alan Sugar, you know, which is always, you know, a worrying moment when his number kind of crops up on my phone. And he said, what are you, well, you know, what are you doing? I explained what I explained to you. And he said, look, I'll say this to you. You know, I've done things in a rash of temper in my life many times. You know, what a surprise. He said, and it has cost me millions. So just be careful. I said, fine. I said, but look, you've got to understand. Say The Apprentice. Big success it is. Suddenly they said, right, thanks, Alan, you're doing all the shows, right, until the final, but we'll bring Richard Branson in for the final instead. He said, what would you do? And he said, I'd tell him to fuck off. He said, well, why are you having a go at me? He said, the difference is, I've got 867 million quid in the bank. As far as I know, he said, you haven't. So think carefully. Fair play, Alan. He was right. But we sort of stayed friends. And in fact, the day it was announced, when he it's funny, the same thing happened in a different way when I was sacked from ITV in the end. But on the day I went to, the day it was announced that I was going to ITV, I remember I was in my car and it was on the car phone. And he said, the phone went, it was Alan. I thought, oh my God, he's going to bloody tear me a new one here. And he went, look, I just want to say, you know, I really enjoy working for you. I think it might be a mistake, but I really wish you all the best. Hope we can still be friends. And then, like, I really got emotional. You know, it's a bit like that bloke who was slating me on Twitter and then saying, but it's a brilliant programme. It's like coming from him.
Yeah.
The other one is when it got in the papers that I was no longer required to present the football on ITV, which you can imagine was a big humiliation. And there was like a photographer outside my flat and this was all kicking off. It was on the news and everything. And I thought, oh God, right, here we go. So walked out of the house. Photographer, I was trying to dodge him, but I went the other way and he came sprinting round. And I remember Frank Skinner had actually said, you know, if something bad's happened, you've got to smile because the shot they want is of you looking miserable, which is my default look. So that of all mornings to be forcing a smile. So anyway, he sort of got the picture and then it was a really bright sunny day and he just looked a bit crestfallen. And I realised, I said, I don't know what's happened here. The sun's behind me, so you can't see a thing, can you? And he went, do you want me to walk the other way? And he went, yeah. So, all right. So he stood the other way. And then it really helped me paint the smile on. And it was like, you know, so I could smile walking the other way. Anyway, I had to go and see my dentist that day. I was taking loads of calls from people and stuff. But I walked all the way into the middle of London where my dentist was. He was a mate. And he says, you all right? I said, yeah, I'm fine. And then it was the most peaceful half hour because I didn't actually have to talk. It's great being the dentist. You just don't have to talk. You're messing around your mouth. And then I finished. And I'd been fine all day. I felt fine. And then I got a text from Roy Keane. Right. And he said, look, I'm absolutely gutted for you. It was along the lines, I can show you it later. I'll come to my phone somewhere. I'm gutted for you. You know, I really enjoyed working with you and I consider you a friend, you know, and I hope we get to work together again. At which point, I completely lost it. Because, you know, when Roy Keane's got his arm around your shoulder, you know you're fucked. Something really terrible, you know, must have happened. But actually, Roy has been absolutely good to his word. You know, I know we're not close friends with him, but he's always kept in touch. He's always got my... I had some friends from Israel who were coming over for it was the boys' bar mitzvah, and he was a big Man United fan, and there was a big Man United game. He said, can you get us a ticket? And I said, actually, they had to come on a Sunday because they couldn't go on a Saturday because they're sort of Orthodox Jews. I said, Roy, right, can you do anything? You know, and he broke his balls to get him a ticket and leave him there, you know, and that stuff is, you know, that stuff's important, you know, so it's, you know, I'll kind of sort of value that in him and many others I work with.
Sure. So, I mean, do you think that the part of it was, you know, you'd build, it's the British ways, and you get built up, and then people sort of wanted you to fail, or do you think it was just a shift in the timing
I think,
of the
no,
day?
No, I think...
Because it's the same relationship.
A number of things went on. I think that our selling point was the same with Christine. We were both sort of the boy next door, the girl next door, who against sort of improbable odds, her, some of being from Northern Ireland, you know, me, apart from, you know, despite my accent and my looks and everything, managed to, you know, get on, make a success. So, you know, people felt part of your success. But then you get a big job and everyone starts talking about telephone numbers you're earning. Then you can't be the boy next door anymore. It's interesting. Something struck me once when I was... If somebody famous and successful I knew, I went out with for a bit. And I'm saying to her, I go, we're so lucky, you know, I feel so lucky, you know, you've done well, we're lucky. And then she said, look, don't fucking involve me in that. If you want to consider yourself lucky, you consider yourself lucky. But you know, I'm here because I'm fucking good. I'm funny. I'm brilliant at what I do and work my ass off. I'm not lucky. I deserve this. Now, she wasn't being arrogant, but she was making a point. I thought, yeah, that's right. You can't go around all the time thinking, this is just luck, although I still do. And then when I was then earning a lot of money, not as much as in the papers, but I was, you know, by any estimation, it was a lot of money. Otherwise, you end up loathed for that. And I sort of get that, you know, life's hard for struggles for a lot of people, you know, and I don't lose sight of that. But I realised I was being hated more for what I was earning doing something than, say, I'd won 5 million quid on the lottery.
Yeah.
People go, oh, no, fair play, put it on the lottery. But then obviously that is luck.
Yes.
So why would you be hated less for that than doing a job, which in some people's estimation wasn't particularly good, but at least I was working for it in some measure. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, it's strange. But, you know, that's the way the world, you know, people are logical, as we're seeing in the world now, in general. Yeah.
But what I found doing, I am genuinely, and I bore myself, I'm genuinely negative. I literally, well, I'm staying with my parents tonight in Hagley. If I get back there alive, I don't even take that for granted. And it's literally just getting on a train, going to Hagley and
Birmingham,
walking back to there. But it's like a pleasant surprise to survive another day. I'm very negative about sort of everything. I mean, so I think it's from being a West Brom fan, seriously, I think that's a contributing factor. But I honestly said, I remember saying to Christine and the guy who came from the one show with us to work on Daybreak, I said, this is absolutely going to work. I feel sure of it. And Christy was looking at me. Fuck, this is a worry, this is. I've never heard you bloody confident about anything. And I'm never going to be confident about anything again because it just didn't work. Well, I actually found the key problem is, and it's absolutely critical if you're on a breakfast show, is that I'm just no bloody good in the morning. I don't mind being up, having a read, drinking a coffee, having a walk.
Yeah.
Great. But I just don't want to fucking talk to anybody, which is just completely useless.
It could be good. I'd watch that show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get it because my wife's like that anyway in the morning. So basically, I get that show every morning.
Yeah. We should get together.
Yeah. But, you know, did you still get paid all the money even though they sacked you, or do you have to give some of it back?
Up to a point.
It's all right, isn't it?
That's a long ago.
Lives in Chiswick.
Something I did find is that you can move away from what you're good at. If you want to be a journalist, what you go into it for is to ask people questions. And especially once Daybreak had finished. And I thought, you know, Daybreak's figures weren't much different when we stopped doing it to what they are now. It's just got a bigger, sense of itself. Just Piers' sheer bluster, you know, and he's a friend of mine and I really like him, but, you know, he's got that self-confidence and bluster to just push it through. I just haven't got that shot in my sort of psychological locker, you know, at all. But actually, I lost my thread. What was I saying then? I forgot what I was saying. Hang on.
I got just confused when you said Piers Morgan had a friend. That just floored me.
Look, taking us a find. He's been brilliant. But it's when you're doing football. Yeah. But when you're presenting football, you don't really ask. If you're doing Champions League football, you say hello at the beginning. You ask. You've got 2 minutes to ask a question each to three pundits.
Yeah.
And then you go an ad break. And then you come out and you ask. And well, basically, you hand to Clive Tilsley. Half time, ad break, question each to three pundits. Ad break, back to Clive. Afterwards, ad break. Three more questions. Someone else does an interview with Gabriel Clark does the interview with the manager and then come out bang on time. Right, it's very difficult to shine. You're just about getting the words out in the right order and everyone says you're a complete fucking twat anyway when you're finished. I'd realised I never actually interviewed anybody. I haven't actually sat down and asked questions of somebody for 10, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It hardly ever happened during that era. And then suddenly, when I went back on Radio 5 Live, I felt the blood flowing back into my veins. Something felt different. I thought, oh, yeah, I'm actually doing what I came into this for. You know, but you know, don't get me wrong, the football job was fantastic. The crack was unbelievable. You know, World Cups, you know, flying off to Madrid, you know, to Munich, whatever, and far-off places, in Moldova, you know. I'll treasure those times.
Yeah.
But it was less about the football and the broadcasting than just wandering around towns, speaking to locals, you know, eating the food, you know. It was a brilliant experience.
I mean, to get to do it at all is an incredible thing. And that you see this, you know, and it's very rare for anybody in any of these businesses, you know, in anything to do with showbiz, especially in TV, to just work constantly at a high level. So there's ups and downs for everyone. Yeah. And I think the ups and downs are really important, right? You know, I think, like, if you just keep on going on that trajectory and then... Then you will be a dick and you will not have everything in perspective and you won't be doing what you actually want to do.
So it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting now when people say... I mean, at the moment I do 2 3-hour shows on Five Live. They're solo speech shows. Now, the difference with that is, off the back of that, I'm not saying it's any good, but if it is any good, you've bloody earned it and you've done it yourself. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. There's nowhere to hide on a solo speech show for 3 hours. And so, you know, that makes it better when you then get on the tram and somebody says, "Why aren't you on telly anymore?" You know, I don't know. Actually, I said another, it also happened on the tram. I swear this is true. Monday morning, I used to work on Mondays, on the tram, and I was in a grump. It was morning. It was 7:30. It was winter. The tram was busy. And a bloke said, "You're not on telly anymore." I went, "No." And I go, so what are you doing now? And I heard myself say, I hadn't planned it, I went, "I'm a shepherd." And he went, "Oh." No further question. Like, where are your sheep? Where's your crook? Just what are you doing on a tram in Manchester if you're a shepherd?
Just on my way out to the sheep. Yeah.
They get on the other tram, they're off to the bloody airport, the twats. There's a mate of mine lives not far from here, Jonathan Trott. You know, one of the greatest batsmen ever, you know, and then he's retired from cricket now. And we spend quite a time together, both into baseball, so occasionally go over the States for a sort of break and watch baseball over there. And it's something just before he retired, I said, "There's a word you're going to hate. There's a word you're going to hate, and that word is pipeline." People talk to you, people be nice, you said, "Anything in the pipeline?" That becomes a killer. It sounds like nothing. But, you know, the pipeline question. So I said, whenever I said to him, whenever anyone says the question, whenever anyone uses the word pipeline, just send me a text that says cunt. And I'll know what's happening. And vice versa. So wherever we are in the world, and he's been off coaching the England A's in India, I just suddenly get 3 o'clock in the morning, cunt. That means somebody has asked the pipeline question. Do you end up making stuff up? You know, well, I've got some shepherding work coming through or something like that, but... I mean, what's interesting, actually, is since I did that drinking programme, that conversation has changed because instead of you're not on telly anymore, it's kind of, you know, how's your drinking going? Good luck with your struggle, you know, which, like, comes from a good place. It's not quite like that, but... Now, that's had a bigger impact than, you know, anything I've ever done, you know, just stumbled into that.
Well, that's interesting. So what, you just worked out that you were drinking like 100 units a week just
well, you know,
as your
not
social
even that.
Drinking
I just or... thought it's an issue. I thought to some extent we are, you know, to some extent we're all, everyone who drinks is slightly addicted to alcohol. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a conversation with Frank Skinner, and he looked horrified. We were having dinner somewhere, and he would say, "But you're fine. I mean, you have a couple of pints." He said, "I envy your level of drinking. You know, I couldn't do that." You know, as he would describe himself, he was a, you know, a bedwetting, perno in the morning type alcoholic. Yeah. You know, and I certainly wasn't that. And the trouble is, with most coverage of drinking that you get, of alcoholism, like everything else in the media, it's the extreme end.
Yeah.
So it's all that perno in the morning, blue lights, liver disease and everything. So the rest of us drinkers would look at that and think, well, I'm not like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Ergo, I'm all right. When I thought, well, are we all right? But I said to Frank at this dinner, I said, look, if my 50 best friends had gathered in a place across the road to see me tonight for my birthday, I would be looking forward to it so much less if I couldn't drink. And Frank was staggered. I mean, and coming from him, he said, really? We said, well, perhaps you have got a kind of a problem. So, but I didn't know how much I was drinking until literally the first day of filming, where I did some filming in a pub before, and I had 4 pints of Guinness, which before a game, especially actually, to be fair, for a 12:30 kickoff, so I was in there at 10, right, which is rare, but by no means unheard of. And then I didn't drink anything all afternoon, and then went back to London. It was my mate's 40th birthday, so I went to that. I had a couple of beers when I went in, quite a bit of wine. Then another beer, went somewhere else. And we were filming the following day and I counted it up, and that was 36 units. I mean, at that moment, the penny dropped, actually, once you count it. So that is 2.5 times more than's good for you in a week.
Yeah.
Drunk in one night. And I thought, blimey. A bloke came to me, I was at the Blues Albion game in St Andrews, must have been September, October. It's amazing, people's, you know, really wanting to talk about it. So people were clambering over seats at halftime to come and sort of talk to me and everything about the drinking and their drinking. So I had what amounted to a kind of a public health seminar in the away end at St Andrews. And one bloke said to me, he said, I'll get you. I saw what you did. I said, yeah, I'll get you. I'm like that. He said, but I'm drinking. Do you think this is too much? He goes, I'm drinking 50 pints a week. Do you think that's too much? And it's interesting how much, having spent a lot of time with doctors and hepatologists, I've become a bit of a, you know, celebrity figure for them to speak to. It's amazing how you start talking, Dr. Cobbler. So instead of saying, of course it's too fucking much, you idiot, you went, well, you might consider cutting down a little bit. But my point to him, what I said to him, was that, look, if you're really enjoying all of those 50 pints, you're loving the bones of every one of them, then what I'd honestly say, fuck it, just drink them. But what I found, I made a little back-of-the-envelope calculation, so I started drinking, 15 in Hagley, getting served underage in pubs and whatnot. If you lined up all my drinks in all those years, right, I reckon that, I calculated that'd be between 3.5 and 4 miles long.
Right.
If you lined them all up.
Yeah.
I just, the real tragedy is this. How many of those drinks did I really want, stroke, enjoy, stroke, need? Right, and I reckon it's no more than a third. The rest of them have just been, it's just sort of habit, drinking for the sake of drinking.
If you can drink less than a pint and a half, you get to quite a nice little mellow stage, but then you ruin it by drinking another pint.
Absolutely, but absolutely right. The rest beyond that is just habit. You see, I was with Lee Mack last night working on a programme at Sky, and Lee stopped drinking. I think he's got some role with alcohol concern. I said, well, why did you stop? And he said, I realised it was all bollocks. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, the drink I really enjoyed, he said, was the first, but with what everyone always says, it's the first pint. You get in the bottle, the first glass of wine. Oh. Now, we've all had that. And that's what I kept talking about in the film. That's what I couldn't do without. And he said, well, that feeling's bollocks. I'll tell you why it's bollocks. It's because it takes half an hour for that alcohol to get in your bloodstream. So whatever you're feeling at that moment you drink the first pint, it is not the physiological effect of alcohol on your system, and it might be the anticipation of that feeling coming. In fact, that's what it must be. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I thought that's a good point. But an interesting discovery, by the way, I made since making that programme, just writing stuff for the liver specialists, is that looking at the figures of how much people drink, right, 5% of people drink loads, right, which is plainly unsafe. I mean, north of 60, 70 units every week. And actually, I was well edging towards that. Then another 25% drink between 14 units a week and 35 units for women or 50 units for men a week, or in that bracket where you are causing some harm. And I found, I had a scan on my liver, and it was, you know, I've got some level of fibrosis from what drinking's done, so I kind of had to cut down. But that's that. That's another 25%. So the shocking statistic to me is that 70% of all drinkers are actually drinking 14 units or less.
Yeah.
Now, that's amazing, because nearly every drinker I speak to, bollocks. That's bollocks. Now, it's not, you know, as much as anybody can, you know, it's a huge sample based on a huge amount of research. So that is really amazing to me. So one of the many excuses drinkers like me used to give, you know, I don't drink, you know, there are millions of them. No, I haven't got a problem because I do a lot of exercise, because I don't drink during the day, because I don't drink on my own, because this, I don't drink spirits, I don't, you know, this, that and the other. I don't mix drinks. All this bollocks. Another one of those was, well, everybody drinks. Well, actually, not everybody drinks. No. And also, the vast majority of the people who do drink are keeping it to 14 units or less. You know, so it is basically possible.
Lightweights, aren't they?
Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, my whole, not social life, my whole way of interacting in people is built around drink. Like, yeah.
I think that's the problem.
There's a friend of mine, it's Karen, we go for a drink after. I wouldn't know, kind of, what else would we do if we didn't go for a drink? We can't drink coffee for hours. We can't go for a walk. What is there to do apart from drink? Life's got no meaning without a drink.
Drink water. Herbal teas are nice. I haven't had
but
a drink.
But you can't sit in a pub for 4 hours.
You can.
And drink herbal tea.
You can.
No, you can't.
You can. It's nice. Do sign up for Beer 52 as well if you so I wouldn't do it because I don't drink anymore. Let's ask people be cross if I don't ask you some emergency questions. I'm going to ask you some emergency questions.
Can I get a picture of the audience with the lights up at some
stage? I'm sure we can. Yeah,
like to...
we can do that. I'm sure we can put the lights up and have a picture of the audience.
We do that. We can do it later if you want.
No. Okay. We can't.
No, we can't. Okay.
I mean, I'm a bit terrified of seeing 1,000 Birmingham people in one place with the lights on.
They're all cardboard cutouts at the back that your agents put in.
There might be no one can turn the lights on. Oh, there's a man moving. It could just be someone leaving who doesn't want to be seen by Adrian Charles. The last thing.
On.
Have you ever seen a ghost? Yeah, so maybe. Ah! What a time for that.
Blimey.
But even with the lights on, there's a big swathe of people there that the light is repelled by. It just seemed dark. No, the magic is... How'd you get a dirty lens?
Okay, wave everybody or make wanker signs or something. Wave! Yay! Like it. Thank you very much.
Please turn the lights out again. have you seen a ghost? Have you ever seen a ghost?
I don't know. Sometimes I get funny feelings in the middle of the night.
Do you?
But I feel paranoid.
You have that. So you end up with a dirty lens on your phone.
I've only ever had one wet dream.
Really?
Yeah.
Is he answering questions I haven't asked yet? Yes. These are all good.
And I remember it.
How many wet dreams?
I remember it precisely.
Yeah.
I remember where it was. It was my mum's house in Croatia. Yeah. And I was about... I wasn't driving. I know I wasn't able to drive at the time because the dream... the dream...
If anyone's had a wet dream when they're driving, that is very bad news.
But I was in bed. I was in bed with my brother, three years younger than me. Okay.
That'd
not that he knew, I didn't ejaculate all over him or anything. But the dream was, I was in Croatia on this island, and I had a dream that I was driving my mum's light blue Ford Cavalier out of the multi-story car park in Stourbridge. Okay. And every time, because you go down a ramp and then along a bit and then another ramp and round. And every time I went down a ramp, and then around, and then, and then finally when I came out into the open air onto the Stourbridge Ring Round, I ejaculated. Is this the kind of thing you want?
Yeah, well, I'll take it. It seems to be coming whether I want it or not. Have you ever driven down that since... subsequently, or were you scared to drive down?
No, I have. In fact, when I go to Mass at Stourbridge, that's where I park.
Is it?
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus is a kind of ghost, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've seen... have you ever seen Jesus?
Well, Jesus is in all of us.
Is he? Rich. Yeah.
No, I don't. Not as far.
But
as
you are. You're religious. You did a kind of... I did 50 dates in 50 days once. You did 46 masses in 46 days for Lent, was it?
Yeah, that's just after I got the boot from ITV, and I was down in... I thought Ash Wednesday, everyone goes, you know, Catholics go to Mass, and I was in South Wales, and I found a little church, so I go for Mass. Although it was really interesting. It was a really little church in a crappy area of Swansea, and... it was really a nice little Mass, and I was down there the following day. I thought, I'll go to another Mass on the Thursday, and then went to another Mass on the Friday at a different place. And I sort of thought, can I do this for 46 days? And it became a bit of a sort of a project. And actually, it was just something I was doing. I mean, maybe I was having a nervous breakdown at the time. Who knows? But I remember talking to Frank about it, and he said, God, even the Pope hasn't had 46 different priests say Mass to him. You should write something about it. So I wrote something about it for the Tablet, a Catholic magazine. I ended up kind of making a television programme. What I thought was interesting about it, actually, I realised how important the kind of priest is to proceedings, which sounds obvious, but whether or not I got anything out of it depended on the priest. And I found, you know, a third of the priests were good, a handful sort of life-changingly brilliant, lovely people, a third were sort of okay, you know, and a third were absolutely shit. I mean, you can't stand in front of an audience, you know, go and talk about great joy and everything, looking as though you've just had your phone bill or something. Just, you know, just not looking pleased to see you. When you talk to people about priests, and they say, yeah, sometimes they say, he's very good with people. Well, that's like saying about a footballer, yeah, he's got a kick in a ball. I mean, it seems to me it's the first, you know, absolute requirement number one is to be good with people. But in a way, it did sort of change my life doing that. I just got on a sort of different, not on a different spiritual path, almost sort of a different career path. Not that that's why I did it, but it was, no, it was interesting. I can tell you're bored shitless.
I'm not bored.
You want to talk about ejaculation
I was wondering about all the units you must have drunk with all those masses, but that's...
Actually...
It turns into Jesus' blood, so it's fine.
I wasn't drinking for Lent either.
You can drink the wine because it turns into Jesus' blood, and you believe that because you're a Catholic, so you're fine.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, you've become a vampire, but that's not as bad as drinking.
That's true. Don't try and get me on Catholic theology. It's above my pay grade.
Why does God let bad things happen to nice people?
It's interesting that, since you ask, because I remember after the Manchester bombing, I was sort of down there on the scene for 3 hours the following morning, you know, which is obviously massive. And I was just, people were saying, well, how can God let that happen? It's kind of part of the narrative of those things. And with those things, look, I'm no theologian, you know, really not much better than an agnostic, probably, certainly in some Catholic eyes. But for me, that's quite similar to explain. You see life as a triumph of good over evil or evil over good. Sometimes evil triumphs over good. So I've got no trouble explaining that in terms of what God does or doesn't do. But when something happens like the cyclone in southern Africa now, or, a kid. I remember filming that religious program. I was in Rome, and I had a really nice priest there and talking. And I was just checking we were driving somewhere, I was just checking my phone, like the BBC News phone. And I saw a kid in Sunderland, a toddler had died choking on a grape. And I just suddenly thought the great sweep of religious history suddenly meant nothing. You know, gone from a believer in that moment to, I'll fucking give over. You know, how can that happen? So, look, God, I'm not sure. I just don't know.
Yeah.
You know, just go and sit in a Catholic church, you know, not during Mass. Sometimes Mass feels like a penance, that means a membership of the club, to allow you to go and sit in a Catholic church. You just think, oh, yeah, that's nice now. You know, that's it. How can I go from ejaculation to Catholicism?
It's like being on the One Show.
Yeah.
Let me ask you another emergency question. It was a good answer. Another answer might be, there is no God. There's no one looking after anything where it's all a pointless waste of time. So, let's look, just for the people of Birmingham, let's go very old school. Would you rather have a hand made out of ham? They'd just be happy.
Sorry, say that again.
Would you rather have, we've only got halfway through, would you rather have a hand made out of ham or an armpit that dispenses sun cream? If that was the choice. You can ask subsidiary questions or just answer
straight. Sun cream, definitely.
Sun cream?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, don't like... No. Why? Why? Why would you make that choice? The hand will grow back if you eat it. Slowly.
Yeah, but I'm vegetarian anyway. So,
yeah, but it's not made out of...
Animal matter.
No, it's not. It's you've created out of your own... Would you eat your own fingernails?
No. Look.
Would you eat...
You can't question me. You asked me a straight question. I told you a straight answer.
I can question you. I'm going to press you, Minister.
I'd have factor 20 out of one arm and factor 50 out of the other.
Okay. It's only one armpit, and you only get one factor, and you have to
all
stick
right,
with
I'll
the factor.
I'll go for factor 50. I was talking to some dermatologist, and they said no suntan is healthy. You know, cells are dying. So yeah. You've got to... Anyway, it's your public health announcement. Stay below 14 units a week and never get a suntan.
No drinking, no going out.
Midlands football is shit, and we're all going to hell in a handcart. Thank you very much. Have a lovely afternoon.
We've done very well. We've been going... Oh, God, we've been going for ages. We're going to end soon, because I want to go home. Quite nice doing one in the afternoon, isn't it? I could go home and just miss the kids' bath times. It's perfect. Absolutely perfect. I won't. Have you ever seen a Bigfoot?
Not that I recall.
Good to
no,
think about it.
No.
All right. If you could have a... I'm going to make this a new question. If you had a finger that could travel through time, what would you do with your finger and where would it go? It creates a small wormhole and you're able to look through, but you can only get a finger in and then you can flick something, I don't know, touch something. Yeah, it's like that. It's very much like that, yeah. It's very similar to the rimming. It's actually very similar to rimming. Which I guess you could do if you could persuade, like, Napoleon to stick his ass up against the hole. They've turned the lights back on again. Oh, my God. Scary. Is there anything you'd like to do with your finger in time? This might be telling us we have to stop. I don't know. Or is...
I can't believe you've had to sign all this. What does she do for ejaculation?
What does she do for a wet dream coming down the car park?
The worst day I've ever had following the Albion, sorry to go on and bang on about the Albion, was the playoff final of... the playoff final of... would have been 2007, I think, where we lost to Derby County 1-0 at Wembley. Oh, shut up. did Giles Barnes score that goal? Can you remember? Were you there? Anyway, I'm pretty sure Giles Barnes scored the goal. Now, as he went on that run towards the goal, I would run alongside him as fast as I could. I'd have to train because he was really quick, Giles Barnes. And at the moment he pulled the trigger to shoot, I would have inserted my index finger into his bottom. And if he still scored in those conditions, then fair play. They can have that.
It's a good answer.
Well, what kind of other answers have you had for that?
Well, all sorts of amazing things. I mean, it's not a good question. That was a good answer. You can poke Hitler. What's Hitler? That, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's what I'd have done. Yeah. I mean, most of what you do is just made up as you go along, isn't it?
Can you just say stuff so I can get this?
Filming this?
Yeah,
it's been filmed, but I've done it this, so we can get you a copy of it.
I need to film. Go on, say stuff.
Hello, everyone in Adrian Charles' phone. Who knows who this is going to? Hello, Adrian Charles' brother. Sorry about what happened to you that time in bed with him. It wasn't an ectoplasm, like he said. Have you got enough?
I'm just
going to
leave it there.
Okay, you're going to leave it. We'll keep going. I don't know whether do we have to wrap up? Is that what the lights are on for? Or I just saw my producer walk out that door, so I don't know, that's a chilling moment. You still got film in the camera, Chris? Yeah, it's fine. Okay. Well, we won't do too much more. Let's see what else. You once raised £60,000 by shaving off your beard.
We were scrabbling around for... I came back after Christmas with a beard, and this might have brought about the end of my career on the One Show, actually, because I came back for Christmas with this beard and someone said, oh, it looks all right, so I left it on. So I left it on and people started commenting on it. Actually, I thought I'll just leave it on, so it became a thing. But then the controller, who then later went on with the Chris Evans business to quite effectively boot me off on Fridays, somebody told me that she'd rung up and said, Adrian, the beard goes. And I was dying to shave it off, but at that point, I'm thinking, fuck this. I don't care. I end up looking like a submarine captain. I'm leaving this beard on. So we turned into a bit of a thing. So in the end, the compromise was that I got it shaved off to raise money for, I think, Children in Need. So I was scrabbling around for sponsors to do it. And in the end, I just called Alan Sugar. I said, can you help me out? He said, yeah, I'll give you 60 grand. That's fine, just do it. So to be fair, he did. Remember, that beard was even reviewed in the Daily Telegraph. And I was very, I'm not really a natural sort of beard grower. And I think it's a guy called Christopher Howes who writes for the Telegraph, and he reviewed, he's got a big beard himself. He said, you know, he said, it's not much of a beard, but at least Chiles has got past the Yasser Arafat stage. I thought, that's as much as you can hope for, isn't it? I'd gone sort of post-Arafat.
Well, my producer walked through that door, went like this, and then also let the door slam, which is very poor producing. So if you heard a slam on the audio version, that was Ben Walker, our producer, who I'm indebted to for his work. He's at the back smirking as if that's a cool thing to do. You'll be sacked. Like, I'm going to be like, Adrian Charles, you're tying my shoelaces from now on, and I'm going on to Stuart Goldsmith's podcast for a record fee.
So I'm not used to live audiences. But seriously, you get... But you might have 20 million people watching an England game or something. You can't see the fuckers. Do you know what I mean? But no, you can see them. They look quite happy, though.
He'll be using this later on for his wet dream material, don't you worry. Well, look, I think we're going to have to wrap up because, you know, Birmingham can only take so much excitement and I don't know what's going to come out your mouth next. But ladies and gentlemen... Don't film her when she's not doing anything.
Hang on a bit.
There we go.
Hang on a bit. I think... How did she do this? I think the signing woman is brilliant.
Hey. That's just made her look like the most arrogant person in the world. There's another lady as well backstage. So. Anyway, please give a massive round of applause. He's one of yours... You have to
tough luck, I am, sorry.
The chin. What, you got anything else in the pipeline?
Oh, God.
Ladies and gentlemen, Adrian Childs!
You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Adrian Childs. That was a turn-up, wasn't it? Thank you to Pest for playing this music. Thank you to everyone at Birmingham Town Hall and the Birmingham Podcast Festival. Thank you to everyone at Acast. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Go to rahalaspa.co.uk for more information. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.